All right, we go to the phone. Let's give a nice warm Radio Vermont welcome this morning to General Gordon Sullivan, who's joining us live on the line. He's the president of the Board of Trustees down at Norwich University. He's also served as the Army Chief of Staff under Presidents Bush and Clinton. He is a four-star general, and he was back in 2007 part of the group that looked at this question about climate change and national security. He will be speaking tonight at Plumbery Armory at 7 o'clock tonight. General, thank you very much for joining us. How are you this morning?
Good, thanks, Mark. Great. Nice to be back in Vermont. Sunny day, but cold.
Yeah. It is, you know, a cold day in Vermont is better than a good day somewhere else, though. No
question. Sure is. But it's a lot better than Washington, I'll guarantee you that.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's cloudy and poisonous down there, the atmosphere. You're going to be speaking tonight about a subject that actually you're pretty familiar with. I mentioned that back in 2007, you were part of this group that really looked at this, what I remember, really for the first time, this question of national security and climate change. How did that study come about?
Let me give you some background. The study was sponsored by some foundation donors who gave money to what is known as the CNA Corporation. Now, let me decipher CNA for the average person. CNA really is the initials for, it's an acronym, for what was at one time known as the Center for Naval Analysis. The Center for Naval Analysis was primarily devoted to maritime issues, architectural work on ships and armament on ships and power propulsion units and so forth. And as things evolved in Washington, it was desirable for them to broaden their scope, if you will, and they became the CNA Corporation. It's a think tank that's devoted to issues across the spectrum of policy issues impacting the United States and our efforts around the world. So in 2006, they being the leadership of the corporation, created a group of retired general and admirals to take a look at the national security implications of global climate change. And most of us were field people who worked in the operational field of national defense and national security for years. Only two of us were, there were 12 on the board. Only two were in the climate business. One was an astronaut, and the other was the oceanographer of the Navy. And they were familiar with, you know, the subject. So at any rate, we were asked to look at this through our eyes, which we did. And in 2007, we published a report, which is on the web, and I think you probably have, for your listeners, the way to get this study, actually that study and the one that was done last year in 2014.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can get it on that CNA.org site. So before when you were brought in to look at this, had this whole question ever crossed your mind before that there were these implications?
Yes, it had, as a matter of fact. I was the chief of staff from 1991 until 1995. And during the time I was the chief of staff of the Army, we became involved in Somalia. You know, all the way from the very beginning through the events of 3 and 4 October 1993 in Mogadishu, and what was known as Black Hawk Down, and then the withdrawal. Interestingly enough, the humanitarian piece of that whole episode because the United States and other countries, Canada and other UN countries, Turkey and so forth, to become involved in Somalia because of a drought. There was a long-term drought in Somalia, which caused the crops to fail, and humanitarian aid was needed. Now, the United States became involved because the images on TV were horrific, and one in particular was a buzzard who was actually larger than the child it was looking at. It was looking down at the child, waiting for the baby to die. And I don't have to draw the picture anymore. That caused the American public to say, we need to help. So off we went with humanitarian aid. And then what we discovered was that the warlords, who were affiliated with particular tribes and clans, would steal the food and control it and give it to their people, their tribes, the people who were beholden to them, and withhold it from the others. And this caused turmoil, obviously, and the troops on the ground started to act to protect, you know, everybody's interests and enable the food to get through to everyone on a sort of a democratic basis, regardless of what family they're in or what clan. And the whole thing deteriorated into something else entirely, which is another subject. But the basic problem was caused by drought.
So that's the thread. I mean, that's the connection.
That's the thread.
Mm-hmm. That climate change led to drought, which led to more serious conflict.
Yeah, I'm not sure, though, truth in lending. I'm not sure that any of us really... We knew it was drought, but whether... I'll just speak for myself. I'm not sure at that point that I knew that the climate was changing, what the trends were. I suppose subliminally I did know something, but it was more there was drought and because of that than this.
And my recollection is that very similar dynamics were at play in Rwanda, too.
Yeah, but not completely. That was between the two Hutus and Tutsis. It was tribal, and they, one tribe or the other, felt that whoever the president was killed, you know, and things just got out of control. There was plenty of food in Rwanda. That was not a problem.
Okay, I just remember there was a resource issue there too.
Well, I'm sure there probably was, but it wasn't apparent to me. The one that's really apparent is Syria.
Uh huh. Yeah. So, what's the climate change implication there? What do you mean?
Well, here's where it really gets complicated. China, Russia, and the United States at the same time had a serious drought, which impacted a long-term drought in the wheat-growing states in the United States and then in China and Russia. And wheat became scarce. Obviously, we're a big exporter of wheat and foodstuffs, wheat and soybeans and other grains, as are the other two countries. Russia stopped exporting wheat to feed their own people. A lot of the caloric intake in Egypt, Syria, in that part of the world, Mesopotamia, North Africa and Mesopotamia, comes from wheat and bread. Well, interesting enough, Egypt at the time and Syria was experiencing a drought. In the case of Syria, the farmers, having no method to generate money of their own, migrated to the city. They became a burden on places like Damascus and Aleppo and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
The government couldn't handle it, and one thing led to another. The other being essentially an uprising, unrest, and uprising. Now, the uprising may have been fueled by people who had completely different motives, but at the base of that was, in large part, related to climate. Now, there's a lot of other reasons. Obviously, extreme versions of what people wanted, and they wanted Assad out, and this. So there's lots of other reasons, but it was one of the causes.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And the same thing in Egypt initially.
We're talking with General Gordon Sullivan. He's going to be speaking tonight at Norwich University, 7 o'clock, Plumley Armory, about the connection between climate change and national security. You say that you didn't really see this in front of your face in Somalia. So at what point did the light bulb go off here for you?
Well, after, you know, sometimes you get into these situations and as you learn more about it, it begins to dawn on you what really caused it. And I think in my case that was true. And then, you know, Somalia, Sudan, where you see the farmers are raising crops, the herders who are in the northern part of Sudan, who are Muslims, want the grain for their cattle. You have a lot of dynamics happening, and it dawns on you that, wait a minute, there's more going on here. Why is it that we're seeing these droughts of enormous, almost biblical proportions? And then I became involved with this study group, and it was apparent that the trend lines that we're seeing are going in the wrong direction.
Is it an issue or a non-issue why the planet's warming?
Oh, it's an issue. I mean, it's a political issue. I mean, I think all your listeners know that. There's people who think it's driven by, carbon in the air, and it's warming the planet. There is warming going on. What's causing it, I'm not sure I'm qualified to say, but certainly glaciers are melting. The Northwest Passage, who the heck ever heard about anybody going through the Northwest Passage in a boat?
Right.
I mean, submarines, yes, but back in 06, I think we had four boats go through. Last summer, we had over 70
mm-hmm.
ships and boats. Some of them, by the way, pleasure boats.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a huge change. And we know that Russia has already staked a claim to mineral rights, as have some other nations done the same. Norway is in there. Obviously, Canada has a vested interest, as does the United States. We only have one or two icebreakers. We don't have the capability or the communications equipment or the equipment.
And ultimately, the biggest threat here is that these states fail and that there's a vacuum. Is that the biggest issue?
The biggest issue is that, you very succinctly, it's almost like you have a dish of milk and you the dish of milk being the food for the cat, and you put it out on the back stoop, and nobody watches it, and the sun hits it, and bad things happen with inside that saucer. And in some of these places, Somalia being one of them, and there's other failed states, which have failed in failing states, which enable extremist organizations to operate almost with impunity. Yemen being another one. And that's what's going on. And these failed and failing states cause regional problems of enormous magnitude because people start migrating. Refugees go to Turkey, overwhelm Turkey's ability to handle them. In the case of Jordan, you see major migrations out of Syria. And the Jordanians, with limited resources, helped by the United States, and God knows how many people who have other motives, are moving into these countries with unforeseen problems developing.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything that can be done about this?
Well, you could, I suppose. Just wonder if anything could be done. I think the wealthy nations of the world are trying to do their best without becoming involved in every fracas in the world. But as you can see, I mean, I think all of your listeners know that in spite of what's being said, that we are, certainly the United States is, and others, our allies, have troops still on the ground and places like Afghanistan. The Army has almost 10,000 troops in Afghanistan still. And other places like Syria and other places in the Middle East, Jordan. And it looks to me as if we're going to be there for a while. I don't see. I mean, I'm sure other people in Washington may feel otherwise, but it doesn't appear to me that it's in anybody's best interest for us to leave.
How does the military have to change, General, in order to cope with this?
Well, I think the military has a keen awareness that one of their missions is to reassure our allies and friends, and that's one of them, and the other is to compel some enemy when you're in that particular environment. And obviously, in the case of the Army, which it's always done, is it supports the missions it's given in a broad spectrum of activities. We've been advisors for over 100 years, beginning in the Philippines, for instance, over 100 years ago, doing the same thing, essentially, mm-hmm. that we're doing now.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Vietnam in January of 1963, and I was an advisor. I mean, we're not that 1963 is that long ago. Feels like yesterday to me, but, you know, so we've been doing it for a long time, and we'll continue to do it. So it's just shifting from one to another, one type of mission to another. Although, to your point, when you do that, when you create advisory capability in an organization, then you must retrain that outfit to do its other missions, like compelling someone. That's a completely different skill set. And mm-hmm. you just can't switch from one to the other overnight. And that's a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not that it's not in the doctrine. It's in the doctrine. We know what the missions are that we'll get.
Well, let me ask the question a little differently, because I know what you don't want to have is the military always just reacting to things. So I'm wondering if this understanding and knowledge that climate change has implications on national security, if there's a way that that information can be used proactively.
Well, certainly the combatant commanders, that is Pacific Command, Africa Command, Southcom down in Miami, they look to parts of Central America and South America, and European Command. They're required now, because of climate change, to have in their planning documents plans related to climate phenomenon, such as floods, stream storms. What will they do during typhoons in the Philippines or Bangladesh or whatever? So they plan to do that, and they train to do it. Although some of that stuff they can do without much, because they have the discipline, they have the helicopters and the equipment, and they can do it relatively easy. The problem is that if you have a smaller military and you have things like Hurricane Irene and Katrina, then the National Guard and the Reserve are consumed in the Dog River Valley, the Vermont Guard, and some of the people from Norwich, even, like the flood in 1927, the pictures are almost the same, then you don't have them. And we need the Vermont National Guard and the New Hampshire National Guard and so forth and so on. So they can't be two places at once. You have the state duties and the federal duties, and the two compete. So you're competing with yourself.
Right.
But the system, the study, by the way, one of the recommendations of the first study was to have a national intelligence estimate done on climate change. And that study was, in fact, done, and it confirmed essentially what the unclassified study suggested, that climate change will have national security implications.
And is there any upside to climate change when it comes to national security, or is it all downside here?
Well, it depends on how you look at upside. I think it's readily apparent to certainly the Army Corps of Engineers and others. Even the New York Times points it out, that what's our infrastructure, the infrastructure in the United States, read railroads and waterways, the Mississippi, even the St. Lawrence River system. The infrastructure is old and needs to be upgraded. Now, how we pay for it is an issue, obviously. But clearly, these storms, and you could see it right here in the Dog River Valley, the railroad, and I don't know what it's called now. It used to be 100 years ago when I was a cadet here. It was called the Central Vermont. I don't know what it's called now, but it was essentially washed out during Hurricane Irene. I think it was called a hurricane. Maybe it was called a storm. I'm not sure.
Tropical storm. Yeah.
Tropical storm. So it was washed out. Well, that, as well as some roads. I mean, over 500 miles of roads and bridges. I mean, it was huge. So all of that infrastructure had to be replaced. But if these storms continue at the rate they are, and by the way, I think it's the 10 most expensive storms ever to hit the United States were within the last 20 years. I mean, this is, like, serious.
Mm-hmm.
And so I suppose you could argue that, well, one upside maybe is that people are listening to the clarion call and starting to pay more attention to the structure. You know, the Excella, for instance, which runs from Boston to Washington, there's a lot of bridges that those lines cross, which were built in the 1800s. Some of them were outdated when they were built.
Right.
I was taking a train out of Boston one time in the middle of the winter, and we had to stop at a bridge and wait for a guy in a pickup truck with a blowtorch and a sledgehammer to close the bridge.
Wow.
He had to hit the pin. You know, you get it hot, and then I think he had another guy with him, and one had the torch and the other the sledgehammer. So I go to Japan and Korea and Europe and ride in these trains that go 200-some kilometers an hour, and I'm thinking of my own country, and I've got a guy with a blowtorch and a sledgehammer.
Yeah.
Okay, so, you know, the upside might be that we start paying attention. Now, I know that the state of Virginia, the Commonwealth of Virginia, and all of the political leadership, because of what's happening down in Norfolk, down at the Hampton Roads area where the Chesapeake and the James River and the whole Norfolk complex, the sea level is rising there at an alarmingly high rate, and there are some days when businesses are closing, roads are closed because of the rising sea level. And the Corps of Engineers is spending a lot of money down there, as they are down in New Orleans. And I think they're going to do some stuff in Miami, too, to mitigate against the effects of the ocean warming. And by the way, mitigation is now an acceptable term, and resiliency. There for a while, nobody would say it but in Washington, but I think now people are beginning to say it, that we can mitigate in some areas.
We're talking with General Gordon Sullivan. He'll be speaking tonight at Norwich University about national security and climate change. So here's what I'm hearing from you this morning here, that it's not only a national security issue when it comes to things such as failed states and places like Syria, but it also sounds like what you're saying is that there's a national security issue with the amount of resources that we're going to have to apply to deal with this.
Mark, you got it. Let me tell you, that what you just said is the big aha. If we can't move our agricultural products into the international market because of drought affecting the level of the water in the Mississippi, then we collectively in the world have a problem. And as you may know, the Corps of Engineers wound up either last summer or the summer before taking obstructions out of the Mississippi, which heretofore had been covered by water. But the water had dropped so far that they needed to remove these rocks, essentially blow them up, so that the barges could move these heavy rafts of, soybeans and wheat and oats and so forth to market. And the Mississippi River system is huge in the economy of the world and the United States. And national security and national defense are two different things. National security involves all diplomatic power, information power, military, and economic. And the world is so interconnected now, as we could see in Syria and Egypt with the China, Russia, and the U.S. and wheat. that if someplace has a problem in one region, it could be reflected in another.
Mm-hmm. Just a couple of other questions. Do you think the military, does the military, generally speaking, take this seriously? Do you think it is an issue?
Well, do I think Private do I think Lieutenant Sullivan knows anything about it? Probably not. Not much.
Well,
I mean, he or she worries about what they have in front of them and so forth. I certainly think the military at the highest level does take it very seriously. That is, the regional commanders, the chiefs of service, and even those U.S. Army Pacific. I know General Brooks, who is the U.S. Army Pacific commander, and his counterparts in the Marine Corps and Air Force, they're very well aware that their biggest problem could be an island nation disappearing.
Mm-hmm.
And the resettlement of those people is a huge deal. And mm-hmm. Admiral Locklear, who is the Pacific commander, has told them that the likelihood of going to war in the Pacific is, it's there, but it's not as pressing as a humanitarian crisis of biblical proportions.
Right.
Of some island just disappearing.
Yep. Hmm.
So, yeah, they understand it. The problem is, I think you were hinting at it, well, what do you do about it? I mean, you could say, okay, alternative. Now, that gets into alternative energy. The study group, by the way, a number of study groups in Washington have indicated that it may now be time to go to nuclear power. I happen to think that's probably a step we should take. We can, in fact, build small nukes, which would power communities and so forth and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Navy has figured out how to do it without having accidents, so I think we should be able to.
Yeah, nuclear power submarines.
Nuclear power submarines and ships. They've done it for years.
Yep.
And I think it's a matter of discipline and standards and specifications. Now, I understand it's what I just said is controversial. I understand that. But I said it anyway.
Mm-hmm. You can't get a windmill on top of a submarine either, so I don't think that would
work. No, you can't get a windmill, and by the way, you can't build windmills. You know, I don't know enough about wind to know, but I know that the investors down in the Nantucket Sound all disappeared, so that those windmills won't go in.
Yeah,
but nobody solved the problem of how to move, who builds the infrastructure to move the generated power into the grid. And that costs money, and nobody factors those dollars in.
Yeah. Last question, if you don't mind me asking, what's your take on what's going on in the Ukraine? Is this something that we should be, as Americans, worried about?
Well, I sure am. And I think most people like me are, because we're seeing, I'll give you my take on it. I traveled throughout Russia on an official visit in the 90s. So I went from west to east, all the way across it. And my impression was, when I saw what happened down in Crimea and the eastern portion of Ukraine. This is a much different army, Russian army, than I saw in the 90s. And what's going on is very dangerous. And I read in the Times a couple of weeks ago some Russian economists, one of them said in particular, look, it used to be all about economy in Moscow. Now it's about the war we're fighting with the U.S. I didn't think they were fighting with the U.S., but that's what he said. And that's troublesome.
Mm-hmm.
That's troublesome. What are we seeing? Are we seeing the 1930s revisited? I don't know. I don't know, but it is troublesome. If you look at the aerial photographs of the airfield at Donetsk, the thing is flat, flat. I mean, it looks like, you know, it looks like a city that was bombed out. I mean, they just pulled out all stops and flattened it.
Hmm.
This is not good. It's not good. And where will they stop? I'm not a doomsayer. People could say, boy, this guy is seeing a, you know, something under every rock. I tend not to be that way. And but I'm calling it like I see it. I just don't know what we're seeing yet.
Well, just keep looking under those rocks there with your blowtorch and your sledgehammer, and you'll be all set. Thank you for your time this morning. Good luck. Good luck tonight. Good luck tonight with your talk.
Yeah, thanks a lot, buddy.
General Gordon Sullivan joining us live on the line this morning. I'd also note, too, I mean, his service, 36 years of service, including Purple Heart, Bronze Star, and a number of other incredible honors. General Gordon Sullivan will be speaking tonight, Norwich University, 7 o'clock tonight. He'll be talking about the connection between national security and climate change. Let me take a moment of your time. Our friends at Nutty Steffs, if you're not heading down to Norwich tonight, maybe you're looking for a nice evening out on the town. And it is Thursday, my friends. You know what that means. It's Bacon Thursday down at Nutty Steffs. You could be enjoying a nice evening out tonight. Maybe enjoy yourself a nice adult beverage. Nice collection of beers they have there, domestic and international. You could also be dipping all sorts of different kinds of bacon. You know, you think there's just one kind of bacon out there. Oh, that is so wrong. And you could be dipping that into all sorts of delicious things, including some great Nutty Steff chocolate. Yes, she does sell chocolate, too. So keep Nutty Steffs in mind, too, when you're thinking about Valentine's Day coming up a week from Saturday. Nutty Steffs is located down in the Middle Ground area there, right next to our friends at Red Hank Cafe and Bakery. And you'll find them, they're right around the corner in the exact same building as Red Hen Cafe. So stop on down there, make it an evening out. They always have nice music down there, too, for Bacon Thursday. And you can also just stop down there any day of the week there and pick up a couple of items or two for yourself or maybe for a loved one, too. Make it Nutty Steffs, and it's, again, going to be Bacon Thursday tonight. Check that out. Take a quick commercial break. We'll be back right after these important announcements.
It's the final home weekend of the regular season for the Norwich University Cadets. I'm George Kummo. Tune in Friday afternoon as the Norwich women wrap up their home season, playing host to Franklin Pierce at Kreitzberg Arena. Then Friday night, it's the men playing host to Castleton State. The men then on Saturday play host to Skidmore in their regular season home finale. Hear all the action this weekend on the Northfield Savings Bank WDEV Norwich Hockey Network.
This has been one heck of a winter, eh? The temperatures are going up and down like a roller coaster. Because of all the snow and ice, the road crews have been adding salt brine overtime. This may be keeping the ice off our roads, but it's putting a ton of salt all over our vehicles. Amy here from Auto Craftsman in Montpelier. I'm thrilled that I have an answer to that age-old Vermont question. How do I keep my vehicle from rusting away? The answer is corrosion-free, a non-toxic mineral oil product. It's odor-free and won't drip all over your garage. It helps protect your car from rust, and it dissolves and neutralizes existing rust and corrosion. And if you undercoat before February 28th, you can save money with our We Love Animals special. For more information, call 223-2253 or go to our website at autocraftsman.com.
Do you or someone you know need health insurance? Vermont Health Connect reminds you that open enrollment ends on February 15th, which means time is almost up to sign up for a health plan. Most applicants qualify for financial help to make coverage more affordable. So if you need health insurance, don't put it off. Also, if you already have a health plan through Vermont Health Connect but think a different plan might be better for you, you need to act before February 15th. Open enrollment is a good time to think about your health care needs, to check and see if you qualify for financial help, and compare plans. Need some help? Talk to a navigator. Navigators have already helped hundreds of Vermonters find plans to meet their needs and fit their budgets, and they can help you. To find one in your area, go online to vermonthealthconnect.gov or call 855-899-9600 toll-free. Visit Vermont Health Connect online, give them a call, or get help from a navigator to learn more.
All right, looking for a great internet service provider? Make it our friends at gmavt.net, because, you know, if you do that, then you'll have a really cool email address. Any of you saw that? What a great ad there was last week in the Super Bowl with Katie Couric and Brian Gumbel. And Brian Gumbel was trying to figure out, this is back in, I don't know, like 91 or 2 or something. It was before we all knew what the internet was. And he was trying to describe there, you know, he said that A with the circle around it, what does that mean? Is that, that's an address? Why would anybody put that in there? Is it about? Does it mean at? So if you want to have a cool email address, like I do, you know, Mark, M-A-R-K, at gmavt.net, you could call the folks at Green Mountain Access today, and then you could have blank at gmavt.net as your internet email address. Wouldn't that be great? Mm-hmm. Do that today. You can call them at 1-888-321-0815. They are also on the web. Guess where? Yep, gmavt.net, a division of Waitsfield and Champlain Valley Telecom. Very much encourage you when you call them. If you're in their service area, speak with them about bundling your services into a nice handy-dandy package. That's going to wrap things up for today. Coming up on the program tomorrow, I'll be heading down to the State House for our traditional Friday broadcast. Among the guests that will be joining us on the program tomorrow, we'll kick off our discussion tomorrow with the Speaker of the House, Shap Smith, joins us right at 9:05. We'll talk with the Commissioner of the Department of Children and Families, Ken Schatz, will join us coming up at about 9:20-ish. We're going to talk about a piece of legislation wending its way through the legislature with the intention of providing further protection for children. There have been some concerns raised about this, so we'll talk about what some of those are and where things might wind up at the end of the legislative process on that. Governor Shumlin joins us coming up at 10:10, and I'm sure we'll probably have another couple of folks that'll join us as well, too, kind of on the spot there. Have a great day, everybody. Come back and join us same time, same place tomorrow right here on FM 96.1 WDEV Warren, broadcasting from the top of Sugarbush, FM 96.5 in Barrie and Montpelier, and the flagship AM 550 WDEV Waterbury and Montpelier. News is coming your way next.